Wednesday, of course, 5 p.m. And of course, that means it is time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. And as unlikely as it is for me to say this, it's something that I almost never say, but Heidi is not with me here at the moment. We've had some technical issues and she got pulled away while I'm sitting here trying to work through what we're dealing with on my own. Hopefully things will be fine though, and she'll be either joining us later in the show or she'll certainly be back with us on Friday. Now, as I'm sure you already know, on Wednesdays we've been working our way through two lists, one called the Top 500 of the Top 40 and the other one the Alternative Top 40. And we've got these two lists running side by side. We have 500 albums that we've selected for each of them, and totaling 1,000, of course. And the whole point of this was to make a point about albums. In my lifetime, albums were probably one of the most important things. It's how I learned almost everything that I know about music. As I sit here talking to you, I am surrounded by them on vinyl, on CD. Of course, I, like everybody else, have got iTunes and I've got, you know, over 100,000 songs there. And I understand that people listen to Spotify or they've got their own services that they subscribe to and that it's really easy to play a song on demand. And it's what everybody, you know, these days loves to do. But we're missing out on one of the most important aspects of our own cultural history. And, you know, albums matter. There's so much that albums can offer you as a package. And I don't just mean vinyl albums, although they are among my favorites of all the formats. But I'm just talking about the way that songs are sequenced, the things that a band might be trying to do, how with albums you get to hear history. You can hear how bands change, how things progress. If an artist wants to make a statement that's longer than just one song, that's an album that allows you to do that. It just makes everything so much richer and more alive. And so the whole purpose of our Wednesday program is and has been to try to make clear how important albums are in history and hopefully maybe even be able to save them to some extent to keep them relevant, especially for people. I don't have to convince people who are my age. It's mostly people who are younger who might not even really even recognize what the album format offered. And even people of my own generation tend to give up on it. We just more or less let technology happen as it does. So let's hope that we're making some headway here. And if nothing else, at least you're going to get to hear some good music for an hour. And I hope that's going to be the case today. Now, Heidi would probably say, you know what? If I'm going to miss a show, this is just as well that this is the one I'm going to miss, because I could spend a good number of years trying to convince Heidi to love the Grateful Dead, to a certain extent. And I think I've dented her sensibilities. I know that there's stuff that she does appreciate, while there's other things, the noodling, as she puts it, that basically keeps her away. Well, 1971, we were still trying to get a handle on the band. The Dead really were perceived as being a psychedelic band until they put out their two classic albums, Workingman's Dead and American Beauty, which really changed everything about the band. But up until this time, in October of 1971 is what we're covering, the band only had one live album. Imagine that. Imagine that from today's perspective, where there are literally thousands upon thousands of shows that all the tapers, as they're called, can basically change with one another freely because the Dead were allowing everybody to record all of their shows. And that's what built Grateful Dead's culture to the height that it has reached. But back in 1971, that didn't exist yet. They were a band, like every other band, putting out albums, playing live shows. The one live album that they had out at this point was called Live Dead, probably an album that Heidi would refer to as a noodly album. And then, of course, those two classic albums that I was talking about. Well, in 1971, they put out an album called Grateful Dead. It's just simple title. It's known, though, as Skull and Roses. The reason that the nickname was given to the album, well, it's twofold. They already put out an album called Grateful Dead, their debut album. was eponymous, simple title like that. This album is a double live album, simply titled Grateful Dead. So the nickname comes from the cover art, this really stunningly awesome gatefold double LP with an artist of a skull wearing roses on its head. And thus the name. Now, the album itself also shows a different side of the Dead, something that we weren't used to. I guess in 1971, we didn't know what to be used to yet. It contains about, say, 50% of the album, some great new material that the band had written, whether it's Garcia and Hunter or Weir, Hunter, or Kreutzmann and Weir, all that. But this, what makes the album unusual is that the other half of the album is made up of cover tunes, where the Dead is actually showing their influence onto the things that they'd been listening to. To this point, there wasn't an awful lot of cover music that the Dead were doing. Pigpen would do the occasional blues song. That was a part of their repertoire. But here, they touch on country. They touch on Merle Haggard. They touch on Noah Lewis blues. They touch on Kris Kristofferson and Chuck Berry. An awful lot of interesting new things to hear for the Dead to give us a new perspective. Now, the album, I'm going to call it Skull and Roses for the remainder of the show, reached number 25 on the Billboard album charts, which makes it part of our top 500 of the top 40. And the album appeared at first on the charts in October of 1971. Now, I think I can safely assume that most Deadheads have a hard time recalling a time when the Dead were not a phenomenon that they later became. But in 1971, which I would say is considered a peak era for the band, they had only two live albums, both of them official. And the family of fans that eventually fomented around the band's culture did not yet exist. This album is referred to as Skull and Roses to differentiate it, but it also marks the birth of Deadhead culture. Inside the original album, the band added a heartfelt plea in its liner notes to its fans by including a call that read, quote, "Dead freaks unite. Who are you? Where are you? How are you?" followed by a request for names and addresses. In that sense, you can say that the birth of Dead culture began right here with the album Skull and Roses. So let's talk about the opening track. The song starts with a song called, the album starts, excuse me, with a song called Bertha. I think one of the best Jerry Garcia, Robert Hunter compositions. It's one of the most energetic, for sure. Up until this point in time, the Dead didn't really do anything you could call, quote, flat out rock and roll, but here it's really awesome. It's stunning. It's upbeat. It's a happy song, and it makes its point profoundly. And I think it's one of the easiest ways for the Dead to attract new fans with a song like Bertha. Now, you'll hear the energy of the song and you'll feel it. And Jerry Garcia sounds like he is so lithe and alive and he's just on the top of his game, and he leans into his guitar solo in the very beginning. If you listen to when the guitar solo finally comes up, you'll hear him slide up the neck to hit a note, and it's kind of like he misses the note. He doesn't quite get there. And in a way, it's one of the beauties of this album. The Grateful Dead had a lot in common with bands like the Allman Brothers Band in that they didn't believe in overdubs. You leave things the way that they are. As it happens, it's the way that it is. So that's pretty much the case of exactly what went on here. That gaff of a note is still there. But what's funny about mistakes is that when you play the record over and over again, they stop sounding like mistakes. You start to basically expect it. It becomes part of the fabric of the song. So now I don't even hear it as a mistake. I hear it as like an integral part of the solo, so to speak. Well, so check out for that part. But in the meantime, just enjoy this as we're going to play our way through the first half of the album Skull and Roses this week. And we'll follow that up with part two, album sides 3 and 4 next week. On American Net Radio, 90.3 WHPC, here's The Grateful Dead with Bertha.
fly if you please. Fry them on my bended knees. Bertha, don't you come around here anymore.
Ran into a rainstorm.
To properly introduce you. I started the whole show off with this incredibly long, boring introduction that I did when you weren't here, saying that I didn't know if you were going to be back for the show, and I'm making excuses saying, well, I don't know if you'd even miss a show about the Grateful Dead.
But I'd miss you.
To answer your question, I don't know who Bertha was, but I will say that the song itself is really important in the Dead lexicon for actually because I think it's a song that brought a lot of new fans to the Dead, and it's the type of song that even if you don't really love the Grateful Dead, most people love Bertha. Yeah, the Los Lobos did a great cover of it, and that brought in even more fans for the band. All right, I mentioned that on the album, they did a lot of cover tunes, and we can, you know, basically the next one is right, we get right to it. And it's another upbeat song. I mean, this is the band basically paying homage to the artists that influenced them, and I'm not at all surprised to find that one of those artists happens to be Merle Haggard. They'll touch upon others, like I mentioned earlier. People like Kris Kristofferson and John Phillips and, of course, Chuck Berry. But here are the Grateful Dead performing Mama Tried on American at Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Freight train leaving town, not knowing where I was bound. No one could change my mind, but Mama tried. troubled child from a family meek and mild. Mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, toward the bad I kept on turning. Left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes. Working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right. Mama tried, Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but I plead and I deny. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
You know, Heidi, I know you're not, you know, like maybe the biggest fan, but one of the reasons I think why the songs are so succinct for the most part on the album, like, you know, not the quote unquote noodly bits that you talk about.
Yeah.
Is because the band itself is sort of shrunk down in size a little bit here. At this point in time, they're a 5-piece unit. There's a, like Tom Constantine, who was their keyboard player, is no longer in the band. Mickey Hart, their second drummer, took a leave of absence.
A hiatus, right.
So he's not there either. So it was a 5-piece. The band basically is probably, like I said, just, you know, leaning back, and they sound sort of like a rock and roll band on a lot of the songs. Now, don't get me wrong. There is a song on the album, and we'll be getting to it in today's show, probably the centerpiece of the album, which is almost 20 minutes long, and it takes up all of side two, which is a song called The Other One, and that has an awful lot of what Grateful Dead fans love about the band, and probably the same thing that makes a lot of other people, you know, keep them at a distance. But on side one, the way the album starts off with Bertha and Mama Tried, it sounds like a really interestingly conventional album. It was enough to make people think that maybe the band had changed in light of the classic albums, American Beauty and Workingman's Dead. This next track is a song that was written by Noah Lewis. It's a blues song. And Noah Lewis is the guy who wrote Minglewood Blues. Minglewood Blues is something that the Dead had been returning to in all various different shapes during their career up until this point. They do a Minglewood Blues. They do a new Minglewood Blues. I think they even did a new Minglewood Blues.
No way. That's so ridiculous.
So that's the same songwriter as we hear here. The track is called Big Railroad Blues on American at Radio, 90.3 WHPC.
Well, I wouldn't be here trying to sleep in this cold. makes the jailer go away now. Don't tell me no lies. Makes the jailer go away now.
All right, that was Big Railroad Blues on the album referred to as Skull and Roses, the Dead's second live album at a time when, if you were a Grateful Dead fan, you had exactly two choices for live albums.
By them.
This or Live Dead. Now, this is the other. I mean, classic live albums were not a big part of the rock and roll pantheon yet. There just weren't that many of them. The Allman Brothers Live at Fillmore East, of course, rose to that level.
Uh-huh.
And so did the first Grateful Dead album, Live Dead. And I think this album deserves its place as well. I think the reason why it doesn't get rated quite as high is because of the fact that the band spends a lot of time on other artists' songs. But to me, it still is it's a great energy, and it's just 50 years on, it still sounds like classic Grateful Dead to me.
I think they were smart to do the covers that they did to help draw in people who might not necessarily get what the whole jam band thing was doing.
Great. I'm glad to hear you say that because I agree with you. Another thing that's interesting is that Robert Hunter was the unofficial member of the band. He was the songwriter, he was the band's wordsmith. And like Bertha was written by Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter.
Right.
Now, he wrote all the words, but everybody associates the song with Jerry as almost as if it's Jerry who wrote it,
right,
meaning the words.
Yes.
And this next track called Playing in the Band is written by Bob Weir and Robert Hunter.
Right.
Same thing again. I mean, the song is so closely associated with Bob Weir that a lot of people who are not really close to the Dead just sort of disassociate Robert Hunter. But he's their wordsmith. He's the ones that...
He's the poet laureate
that gives all of the band its personality. Now, Bob Weir did put out a studio version of this song on his follow-up solo album. It was called Ace.
And was it any good?
It was a great version. It was great. I do give this version the edge, though. It's just great to hear the band doing it. And... moving through all the changes and playing with the time signatures and such. On American Radio, 90.3 WHPC, here's the Grateful Dead with Playing in the Band.
Mind. I don't trust nothing, but I know we come out right.
We talked about this a lot already, the song which makes up all of side two on the album and the song that is most like the material from their previous live album, Live Dead, which had songs like Dark Star and such, which took up an entire side as well. This track, written or credited to the drummer, Bill Kreutzmann, and Bob Weir. I guess Kreutzmann gets credit because he opens the song with a drum solo,
okay,
which constitutes...
That was a very unusual, now or ever.
Right, exactly. And it's a good one-third of the 18-minute track, as he plays the drum solo for about 6 minutes. So settle in and relax and enjoy the other one on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC.
It rainbows spiral round and round, it trembles and explodes. It left a smoking crater of my mind, I like the blown away. But the heat come round and busted me for smiling on a cloudy day.
the bus stop in its place. The bus come by and I got on. That's when it all began. There was Calvin Hill at the wheel of the bus to Never Ever Land.
Coming, coming, coming around.
Coming around.
Coming around.
Coming around.
Coming, coming,
coming,
coming around.
Coming around.
Coming around.
Coming around.
All right, it looks like we might have time to squeeze in one bonus track. And it's kind of cool because I got something that's really relevant to this album.
And fairly rare.
Right. I mean, most of this album was recorded at the Fillmore East in April. I think the first date was April 26th. Now, the Allman Brothers had just recorded live at Fillmore East around this exact same time.
Right.
So, of course, you affiliate them with that venue.
Right.
Well, it turns out that on April 26th, nobody other than Duane Allman came out to appear with the band.
Cool.
And I didn't even know that this track existed until it appeared on a what is also a rare Duane Allman box set that's very hard to find. And on there, they have the song Sugar Magnolia, a cool version of it from April 26th, the exact same date that a lot of the tracks on this album was recorded. So enjoy this, a special rare version of The Grateful Dead with Duane Allman performing Sugar Magnolia on American Ed Radio 90.3 WHBC. Part two next week, folks. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
We've got Duane Allman over here helping out his new on the set.
Thank you. Thank you.